All right, everyone. You ready for a deep dive into a case that's basically legal legend, Sweezy v. New Hampshire? It's a First Amendment showdown from 1957, right in the middle of the Red Scare, and it had a huge impact on how we see academic freedom and political expression, especially at universities.
Yeah, and what I find fascinating is that this case wasn't about some Hollywood star or a government official, you know. It was about a university lecturer, Paul Sweezy.
Oh, I know him. A Marxist economist, right?
Exactly. He refused to answer questions from the New Hampshire Attorney General all about his lectures and political affiliations.
Wow. So he basically said, nope, my First Amendment rights protect me. He was taking a stand for something much bigger than himself, huh?
Absolutely he was.
So to set the scene for our listeners, we're talking 1951. The Cold War is really heating up and fear of communist infiltration is everywhere. New Hampshire goes and passes this Subversive Activities Act, basically giving the Attorney General a ton of power to investigate anyone they thought was suspicious. How did Sweezy end up on their radar?
Well, it all started in 1954. Sweezy, who was a known socialist scholar, gave a lecture at the University of New Hampshire.
Okay.
And he was known to have ties to the Progressive Party, which back then was considered, you know, a pretty left-leaning political group.
Oh, I see. So that caught the attention of the Attorney General and... boom, Sabita time.
Exactly.
So they wanted to grill him on everything. What he said in the lecture, his connections to the Progressive Party, the whole nine yards. But wouldn't it have been easier for him to just plead the fifth and avoid the whole thing?
That's what's so interesting about this case. He totally could have taken the Fifth Amendment route, you know, protect himself from self-incrimination.
Yeah, yeah.
But by fighting on First Amendment grounds, he was making a huge statement about academic freedom and open political discourse.
It's like he was saying these freedoms are for everyone, not just him.
Precisely.
So this case really comes down to this. Did New Hampshire go too far? Did their investigation violate Sweezy's 14th Amendment due process rights by stepping on his First Amendment freedoms?
You hit the nail on the head. New Hampshire claimed they had this compelling interest in rooting out potential subversion.
Right, like they had to protect themselves.
Exactly. But Sweezy's team countered, saying the Attorney General's questions were way too broad, didn't have a real connection to making laws, and would have a chilling effect on free speech, especially in academic and political settings.
Oh, that's a good point. Okay, so we have this epic legal showdown. What happened when the case finally went to the Supreme Court? They must have settled this debate once and for all, right?
Well, not exactly. The Supreme Court, kind of mirroring the divided nation at the time, issued a split decision.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Chief Justice Warren, writing for a plurality of the justices, really emphasized the importance of academic freedom.
I remember reading his words. Teachers and students must always remain free to inquire, to study, and to evaluate, to gain new maturity and understanding. Otherwise, our civilization will stagnate and die. It's like he drew a line saying the government can't just mess with universities and stifle intellectual exploration.
That's exactly it. He argued that without the freedom to explore ideas, even controversial ones, society wouldn't progress.
Makes sense. So it wasn't a unanimous decision then?
It wasn't.
Who disagreed and why?
Well, Justice Clark, for one. In his dissent, he argued that the ruling would tie the hands of states trying to protect themselves from subversive activities. He believed national security should outweigh individual freedoms in this case.
That must have been a tough call to make, weighing the need to protect free speech and academic freedom against a genuine concern about national security. How do you even begin to balance those competing interests?
It's a question that still resonates today, especially with technology constantly changing the landscape. We have new ways for information to spread, and the lines between political speech and potential threats can get really blurry.
That's a great point. So did the court at least give us a clear test to determine when the government can step into these sensitive areas?
Not a definitive test, but they did articulate a principle that later became known as the Sweezy principle.
Okay, tell me more.
It basically states that whenever the government digs into matters involving First Amendment freedoms, they have to show a strong link to a really important state interest.
So no more fishing expeditions based on vague suspicions.
Right. They need a solid reason.
This case really makes you think about the delicate balance between individual freedom and national security. It's amazing how a case from the 1950s can still be so relevant today.
Absolutely.
You know, it's really interesting how Sweezy v. New Hampshire really captures that historical moment, you know, the Red Scare, the Cold War anxieties, all of that.
Absolutely.
Does the legacy of this case Does it still matter in today's world?
Oh, absolutely. More than ever, I'd say. Think about the debates we're seeing now, right? Mm. About free speech on college campuses, laws targeting what some consider divisive concepts, and even, you know, the right to protest. All of these things, the core issues at the heart of Sweezy are still so relevant.
Yeah, that's a great point. That struggle to find the right balance between, like, individual liberties and government power, I mean, it never really goes away, does it?
Yeah.
It really doesn't.
But let's go back to the legal arguments for a second.
Sure.
I think it would be helpful for our, you know, law student listeners to really unpack those, especially if they're just starting to learn about these concepts.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, each side's arguments really highlight the fundamental principles at stake here. New Hampshire argued they had this vital interest in protecting themselves from subversion, you know, using the Subversive Activities Act to justify their broad power to investigate potential threats.
So they're basically saying, hey, we're in the middle of a Cold War here. We need to be able to root out any potential communist activity.
Exactly. It was all about national security and, you know, maintaining order.
Right. But Sweezy's team argued that the question, they were just like way too broad, irrelevant to any, you know, actual lawmaking, and would chill free speech.
Precisely. They argued that New Hampshire was overreaching and that this type of like unchecked inquiry would stifle open discussion, especially in academic settings where, you know, the free exchange of ideas is so crucial.
Yeah, it makes sense. Universities should be places where you can explore ideas freely, even, you know, even if they're controversial.
Right.
Without feeling like Big Brother is watching your every move.
Right, exactly. That's the point that Chief Justice Warren really drove home in his plurality opinion, too. He talked about the importance of protecting universities, what he called four essential freedoms, to determine for itself on academic grounds who may teach, what may be taught, how it shall be taught, and who may be admitted to study. It was like he was saying, you know, hands off our universities, let them do their thing without government interference.
So he's basically saying that New Hampshire's interest in what they called self-preservation wasn't strong enough to justify infringing on those essential freedoms.
Exactly. They hadn't shown a direct connection between, you know, between Sweezy's lecture and any actual threat to the state.
Right. Right. So it's not just about Sweezy's individual rights.
Exactly.
It's about protecting, you know, the core principles of a university as a place for, you know, intellectual exploration, for growth.
Exactly. And Justice Frankfurter, in his concurring opinion, actually took that idea even further, emphasizing the broader societal value of academic freedom.
Oh, interesting. What did he have to say?
He argued that progress in all fields, even science, you know, relies on the ability to freely inquire, speculate, and challenge conventional thinking. Without that, he believed, we stagnate.
I love that. Real progress can't happen if everyone is afraid to, you know, think outside the box or question the status quo.
Exactly. It's about fostering that that spirit of intellectual curiosity and open inquiry. And Frankfurter advocated for a very high level of scrutiny when it comes to government intrusion in these areas. He believed that only the most exigent and compelling state interests could justify such interference.
So the government needed a really, really good reason to step into those protected spaces.
Yeah.
But didn't some of the justices, didn't some of them disagree with this?
Yeah, they did. As we mentioned, you know, not everyone bought into these arguments. Justice Clark, in his dissent, maintained that the state did have a legitimate interest in protecting itself from subversion. He felt that the threat of communism was serious enough to justify, you know, a broader use of government power, even if it meant encroaching on individual freedoms.
That must have been a hard decision for them to grapple with, you know,
right.
Weighing the need to protect free speech and academic freedom against, you know, a very real concern about national security.
Mm-hmm.
How do you even begin to balance those competing interests?
It's a question that's, you know, still with us today, especially with, you know, with technology changing the landscape so much. We have all these new avenues for information to spread, and the lines between political speech and potential threats, they can become very blurry.
That's a great point. So for our law students listening in, what would you say are the key takeaways from Sweezy v. New Hampshire? What should they really be paying attention to as they study this case and think about its broader implications?
Well, I think there are three big takeaways. First, Sweezy shows that First Amendment protections, they go beyond traditional public forums, you know. They protect the free flow of ideas in academic and political spaces.
Right.
It's not just about your right to free speech, you know, standing on a soapbox in a park. It's about protecting those rights in classrooms, political organizations, and, you know, other settings where ideas are debated.
Yeah, that makes sense. What's the second one?
The second takeaway is that Sweezy highlights how important it is to, you know, to carefully scrutinize legislative investigations to make sure they're not, you know, overly broad or intrusive. Mm. The court made it clear that even when national security is a factor, the government can't just, you know, go on fishing expeditions. They need a compelling reason and a narrowly tailored approach.
So the government's actions have to be justified, like proportionate to the threat they're dealing with.
Exactly.
Okay, what's the third big takeaway?
The third takeaway is, you know, Sweezy really illustrates the importance of understanding understanding plurality opinions. Even though Chief Justice Warren didn't have a full majority, you know, those principles he laid out about academic freedom, they became very influential in later case law.
It's kind of like planting a seed that takes a while to fully bloom.
Exactly. And you see this play out in later First Amendment cases where the principles from Sweezy's plurality opinion were cited and further developed. They really became a part of, you know, the legal fabric.
It just goes to show that even when the court is divided, those concurring and dissenting opinions, they can still shape the legal landscape, influence future decisions. It's a great lesson for law students, I think. Don't just focus on the holding. Dive into those opinions and, you know, and really understand the reasoning behind them.
Couldn't agree more. Now, I want to shift gears for a bit and touch on another aspect of Sweezy that I think is often overlooked, but it's really relevant for law students. And it has to do with the 14th Amendment and the concept of incorporation.
Okay. Incorporation. That's about how the Bill of Rights applies to state governments, mm-hmm. right? It always seemed kind of obvious to me, but I guess for a long time, there was debate about whether the Bill of Rights, you know, which initially only applied to the federal government, also restricted the actions of state governments.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it seems obvious now, but back then it was a real question. Could a state just pass a law violating someone's First Amendment rights? The 14th Amendment, which was adopted after the Civil War, really played a key role in changing all of that.
Right, right. Can you remind us what it says, that amendment, I mean?
Yeah, so it includes this clause that states, no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws.
Wow, it's a lot to take in.
It is.
So how does the 14th Amendment connect to Sweezy's case specifically? I mean, he was fighting against a New Hampshire law.
Right? Exactly. That's where incorporation comes in. The Supreme Court has interpreted the 14th Amendment's due process clause to mean that most of the protections in the Bill of Rights also apply to the states. States can't just ignore the Bill of Rights and, you know, do whatever they want. They're bound by those fundamental guarantees of, you know, individual liberties.
And in Sweezy, the court used the 14th Amendment to, you know, to strike down a state law that violated Sweezy's First Amendment rights. It's like a textbook example of how incorporation works, you know, in the real world.
Yes, exactly. And this is, you know, this is so important for law students to grasp because it means that when they're analyzing constitutional issues, they have to consider both, you know, both federal and state levels. The Bill of Rights isn't just, it's not just a constraint on the federal government. It safeguards individual liberties against government overreach at all levels.
This deep dive has been, it's been really fascinating. We've covered so much, the Red Scare's historical context, you know, broken down those intricate legal arguments about the First Amendment and academic freedom, and then we explore the 14th Amendment and incorporation.
We've encountered some really powerful quotes along the way, and you know, really grappled with these enduring questions about, you know, about the balance of power in a democratic society.
And before we wrap things up, I want to leave our listeners with something to think about. You know, Sweezy v. New Hampshire was decided over 60 years ago, but its legacy, you know, it continues to impact us today. We see echoes of it in debates about free speech on college campuses, challenges to, you know, to curriculum content, and even discussions about the role of technology in shaping public discourse.
Yeah, you've hit on something really important. You know, as you all continue your legal studies and begin your careers, remember that the law isn't static. It evolves over time, right? Shaped by societal changes, technological advancements, and, you know, and these ongoing debates about our fundamental values.
So keep questioning, keep exploring, and keep engaging with those complex legal issues that, you know, that shape our world. Who knows? Maybe one of you listening will be arguing a case before the Supreme Court someday, building upon the legacy of landmark cases like Sweezy v. New Hampshire.
That would be amazing.
So keep those legal minds sharp, everyone, and we'll catch on our next deep dive.
Sounds good.
So, you know, one thing that I always found interesting about the Sweezy case is this whole concept of a plurality opinion.
Yeah, it can be a little tricky to wrap your head around. Sweezy is a great example of how a plurality opinion, even without a full majority, can still have a lasting impact. Basically, a plurality opinion happens when, you know, you have a group of justices and they agree on the result of a case, like maybe overturning a lower court ruling, but they don't all agree on the legal reasoning behind it.
So they agree on the what, but not necessarily the why.
Right, exactly. Justices might interpret legal principles differently, or they might emphasize different aspects of a case, you know? And in Sweezy, Chief Justice Warren's opinion, which was all about defending academic freedom, was only joined by three other justices. So it wasn't actually a majority on the 9-member court.
Okay, so if it wasn't a majority opinion, why does it even matter? Like, does a plurality opinion actually carry any legal weight?
It's a great question. It doesn't set a binding precedent in the same way a majority opinion does, but it can be very influential. Think of it like a jury, where everyone agrees that a defendant is guilty, but they can't agree on the reason why. The verdict stands, you know, but without a clear, unified explanation, things can get a bit messy legally.
I see. So how does that play out in the Sweezy case?
Even though Chief Justice Warren's opinion didn't have a full majority, it presented a really strong argument for shielding academic freedom and putting limits on how much the government can interfere in certain protected areas. It served as a kind of guidepost for future courts when they had to deal with similar First Amendment questions.
Okay, so it was like planting a seed.
Exactly.
Maybe it takes a little while to fully bloom, but it's there.
And we see this happen in later First Amendment cases where the principles articulated in Sweezy's plurality opinion were cited and built upon. They really became a part of the legal foundation.
So even when the court is divided, those concurring and dissenting opinions can still have an impact down the road. They can influence how the law develops. That's a good reminder for law students out there. Don't just skim the holding, right? Really dig into those opinions and figure out the reasoning behind them.
I totally agree. Now, I want to touch on another aspect of Sweezy that I think often gets overlooked, but it's relevant for law students. The 14th Amendment and the idea of incorporation.
Oh yeah, incorporation.
Yeah.
That's about how the Bill of Rights applies to state governments, right? I always thought that was pretty straightforward, but I guess there was a lot of debate about whether the Bill of Rights, you know, originally only applied to the federal government, also restricted the actions of state governments.
It might seem obvious now, but back then it was a big deal. Could a state pass a law that violated someone's First Amendment rights? The 14th Amendment, which was adopted after the Civil War, played a major role in changing that.
Right, yeah. Could you remind us what that amendment says?
Sure. It has a clause stating, "No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws."
Wow, that's a lot. So how does that connect to Sweezy specifically? Because he was fighting against the state law in New Hampshire, right?
Exactly. That's where incorporation comes in. The Supreme Court interpreted the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause to mean that most of the protections listed in the Bill of Rights, they also apply to states. So states can't just ignore the Bill of Rights. They're bound by those fundamental guarantees of individual liberties, just like the federal government.
And in Sweezy, they actually used the 14th Amendment to strike down a state law they found violated Sweezy's First Amendment rights. This is a great example of incorporation in action.
It really is. And for law students, it's so crucial to understand this concept. It means that when you're looking at constitutional questions, you can't just focus on the federal level. You have to consider both federal and state levels. The Bill of Rights isn't just about limiting the federal government. It's about protecting individual liberties from government overreach at every level.
Wow, this deep dive into Sweezy v. New Hampshire has been a real journey. We've covered the historical context of the Red Scare. We broke down those complex legal arguments about the First Amendment and academic freedom, and we explored the 14th Amendment and incorporation.
It's been great. We've encountered some really profound ideas and thought about the balance of power in a democratic society, issues that are still so relevant today.
Before we wrap up, I want to leave our listeners with one final thought. Even though Sweezy v. New Hampshire was decided over 60 years ago, it continues to have relevance today. We see its influence in the debates about free speech on college campuses, challenges to what's being taught in schools, and even in discussions about how technology shapes our public discourse.
You're absolutely right. It reminds us that the law isn't stuck in the past. It changes and evolves over time, influenced by social changes, advancements in technology, and the ongoing conversations we have about our core values as a society.
So for all of you future legal eagles out there, keep those questions coming. Keep digging deeper and engaging with the complicated legal issues that shape our world. You never know, maybe one of you will be arguing a case before the Supreme Court someday, building on the legacy of cases like Sweezy v. New Hampshire.
That's what we like to hear. Keep those legal minds sharp, and we'll see you on our next deep dive.
Until then, happy lawyering.